wasn't wrong. All because Nadia had been first. She had been his first love, so maybe in a way, she had the rightful claim to his heart. Maybe it was like how when you stepped out of the grocery store line to grab bread, no one could really be mad when you returned to your spot. It wasn't cutting if you had been there before. He groaned, pushing up the barbell. He'd begun doing this, playing around with her father's weights when he came over. He had put on weight, and he suddenly felt aware of it every time he undressed in front of Nadia. The last time she'd seen him naked, he'd been in elite shape, 220 pounds, 5% body fat. Now he'd grown extra padding on his stomach, his taut calves and biceps softening. He was already turning fat like the alumni who used to visit team practice during homecoming. Luke and his teammates had secretly laughed at them, men who hadn't quit a football diet once the football stopped. That would be him someday, he'd known that, but he hadn't guessed how quickly someday would come. Since he and Nadia had started sleeping together again, he'd begun eating better, avoiding dessert, doing push-ups on the bathroom floor. He felt shy about it, like an insecure teenager. But maybe that was what she wanted. She had loved him then, when he was young and handsome and cruel. He didn't want to be cruel to her anymore, but he could at least be handsome again. "Do you want those?" He racked the weights and sat up, his arms burning. Nadia lingered behind the screen door. "What?" he said. "Take them," she said, pointing to the weights. "But they're your dad's." "He doesn't need them. They almost killed him." She leaned against the doorway, her foot scratching the back of her calf. She was wearing sweatpants, her hair tied up in a bun, and she had never looked more beautiful. He had never seen this side of her before, not the first time. Then, she had gussied herself up every time they went out, wearing miniskirts and cute sundresses and lipstick. He'd loved that about her, how much effort she put into looking pretty for him. But he felt even more connected to this dressed-down side of her. This was the real her, and she trusted him enough to let him see it, the same way he knew that she had seen the real him. Aubrey saw a version of him that was better than he had ever been, but Nadia had seen him at his worst. He'd been selfish and mean to her, but she still wanted him. He felt liberated, knowing that he was seeing Nadia at her worst, too. She had betrayed her best friend to be with him. She felt guilty about their affair, he could tell, even though she wouldn't admit it. Admitting it meant that she would have to stop seeing him. It was easier to pretend she didn't feel guilty. So he pretended too. In her bed that night, he traced his hand down her naked shoulder, missed it by their sweat. "Do you ever think about that summer?" he said.
"Which summer?"
she asked.
"You know the one."
Sometimes he felt trapped in that summer before she'd left for college, wondering about all of the things he should have done differently. If he'd just picked her up from the clinic, if he'd convinced her not to go to the clinic in the first place, if they would have been exactly like this, lying in bed together talking, except with a six-year-old running around in the living room.
"Sometimes," she said. "Do you think we..."
He paused.
"Maybe we should have..."
She tensed in his arms, and he knew he'd crossed a line. He knew by now the topics he could never discuss with her. Aubrey, their baby. He expected her to pull away from him, but instead, she rolled toward him.
"Shh," She kissed his neck, slipping her hand under the covers.
Nadia,
I don't want to talk, she whispered. He would have to stop doing this, wondering about the life they might have had together, the family they might have been. He would have to be grateful for everything she gave him. Baby reaches for Daddy's unshaven face. Baby loves Daddy's rough skin. Baby bounces in the window when Daddy pulls into the driveway. Baby throws a rattle, a pacifier, a ball. Baby's got a hell of a throwing arm, Daddy's friends say. But Daddy secretly hopes Baby has good catching hands. Baby swings at T-ball. Baby chases across soccer fields. Baby lines up for orange slices and water after basketball practice. Baby listens to Granddaddy preach. Baby watches football in Daddy's lap. Baby asks Daddy about his leg. Baby learns about the fragility of dreams. Baby straps on pads and learns pain. Baby stops crying when he is hit. Baby tosses the football in the front yard with Daddy, who always catches the ball perfectly. Baby can't understand why he still drops, but Daddy tells him his hands are too hard. You need soft hands, Daddy says. You touch a girl the same way you catch a football. Soft hands. Weeks after her visit to Dr. Toby, Aubrey made an appointment with a fertility specialist. She'd first read about Dr. Yavari on fertilityfriends.com, the forum where she'd been lurking for the past few months. On evenings when Luke worked late, she ate her dinner in front of her computer screen, slowly scrolling past the giant banner at the top of the Lavender website that read, "There is no such thing as trying too hard to get pregnant." She never told anyone about the website, not even Luke. She didn't want him to think that she was baby-crazed and desperate. But there was something comforting about reading the message boards, about knowing that other women were struggling worse than her. They were, after all, the ones with screen names like Mommy-to-be 75 or Waiting to Expect 82, the ones reporting their last menstrual periods or charting their days past ovulation to strangers on the internet. She pitied these women, except for the ones who were trying for a second or third child. "We all just want one," she always thought, angrily clicking out the website. On the forums, a rambling thread about California fertility specialists mentioned Dr. Yavari, based out of La Jolla, whom former patients referred to as the baby maker. The nickname comforted and disturbed Aubrey. She didn't want to think of her baby as created by a doctor, like some science experiment, but she appreciated the confidence everyone seemed to have in Dr. Yavari. Maybe this was what she needed, to visit an expert. Maybe Dr. Yavari could save her from becoming one of those sad women on the message boards. She called Dr. Yavari's office, and when Luke said he couldn't miss work, she called Nadia and asked her to come with her.
"I can't," Nadia said.
"Why not?"
"Because," she stammered, "it sounds personal. Why don't you bring Mo?"
"She's working too, and who cares if it's personal? You're not exactly a stranger."
She laughed a little, but Nadia was silent. A quiet distance had grown between them since Nadia returned. They still talked occasionally, but not as often as Aubrey had hoped they might. She tried not to take the unanswered phone calls and ignored texts personally. Nadia had her father to worry about. The last thing she needed was Aubrey burdening her with her own hurt feelings. Still, she felt that distance widening the longer Nadia went without answering.
"Please," Aubrey said, I just get nervous, and it'd make me feel better if you were there.
I'm sorry, Nadia finally said. I'm being dumb. Of course I'll come with you. The next afternoon, they drove to Dr. Yavari's office, a tan building with palm trees sprouting in front. In the waiting room, framed photos of mothers cradling babies hung over the receptionist's desk like a promise, but Aubrey felt like the images were teasing, dangling right in front of her the things that she wanted. Beside her, Nadia played with her phone, and Aubrey tried to flip through a National Geographic, but ended up twisting it in her hands into a glossy tube.
Why are you nervous? Nadia asked. Because I know something's wrong with me.
She tensed, waiting for Nadia to ask how she knew. Instead, she felt Nadia's fingers stroke the back of her neck.
There's nothing wrong with you, she said quietly, and for a second, Aubrey believed her.
Dr. Yavari was Iranian, olive-skinned with dark eyes and 30-something, much younger than Aubrey had expected her to be. She welcomed both of them into her office with a smile, sweeping her arm toward a chair in the corner.
Your sister can sit there, she said, and neither corrected her.
Strangers often mistook them for sisters or cousins, or even, Aubrey assumed, girlfriends. She was amazed by their ability to resemble each other, to become family, to occupy at once different ways to love each other. Who were they to each other? Anything at all. While the doctor flipped through her charts, she sat on the metal table, her legs swinging off the edge. In the corner, Nadia leaned against a counter covered in tubs of purple plastic gloves, while Dr. Yavari asked Aubrey a series of questions. How often does your period occur? Is it heavy, light? Any sexually transmitted infections? Have you ever been pregnant? Have you ever had an abortion?
What?
Aubrey said. I have to ask, Dr. Yavari said, drumming her pen against her clipboard. I usually try to wait until the men are gone, you know. It happened in college. She never told her husband, etc.
No, she said. None.
But she appreciated Dr. Yavari's compassion. She hoped the doctor didn't just guess that Aubrey was the type of woman who might have hidden a secret like that from her husband. She would have, but she hated the idea of the doctor knowing this about her. After the exam, Dr. Yavari scheduled her follow-up appointment. Next time, there would be an X-ray to determine whether her fallopian tubes were open, a pelvic ultrasound to test the thickness of her uterine lining and check for cysts in her ovaries, and blood tests to measure her hormone production. When the doctor left, Aubrey dressed, pulling on her clothes that Nadia had folded in a small pile.
I can't believe she asked you that, Nadia said.
Asked me what?
You know, the abortion thing. Why does it even matter?
I don't know. It must if she asked about it.
Still, I can't believe it follows you around like that.
Later, Aubrey would wonder what had exactly tipped her off. The statement itself? Or the unusual softness in Nadia's voice? Or even the way her face had looked under the fluorescent light, slightly stricken with grief? In the moment between when Nadia handed her her cardigan and she accepted it, she knew that Nadia was the girl. Since Luke had confessed to her years ago, she had often thought about this nameless, faceless girl who had gotten rid of his child. A girl he'd loved, but who had vanished, like the baby, both gone forever. On the drive home, traffic in front of them slowed. She gripped the steering wheel tighter as the car inched forward. Beside her, Nadia fiddled with the radio dials until she reached an old Kanye West song they both used to love. One they'd listened to endlessly in her room and danced to together at Cody Richardson's party. She thought about that night, how sloppy drunk she'd been, how easily she'd forgotten everything she didn't want to remember. She could have been anyone that night in that skin-tight dress, dancing at a crowded house party with Nadia Turner. Toward the end of the night, Nadia had looped an arm around her waist and said in her ear, "Let's get you home." And she had nodded, realizing that she hadn't even thought about how she would get home. She had known somehow that Nadia would take care of her. In bed that night, before falling asleep, she'd felt Nadia's hand touch her back. It was a fleeting gesture, casual, like picking lint off someone's sweater. But in that moment, Aubrey had never felt so safe. After she dropped Nadia off, she stopped at the liquor store around the corner. The tiny Indian man behind the counter waved at her as she walked in. The store was mostly empty, a washed-out blonde hauling a six-pack of Coors to the counter, two boys fighting over a bag of hot Cheetos. She grabbed an Italian Pinot Noir because she liked the shiny silver label. At home, she drank half the bottle while she dressed, the other half after she'd already slipped into one of the frilly black teddies crumpled in the corner of her drawer. She shook out the wrinkles, then stood in front of the mirror, fighting with the straps and bows. After the wine, she wouldn't be able to unhook it herself. She imagined herself stuck in the teddy forever. Would someone have to cut it off her, the way her father-in-law had sawed off Luke's purity ring? She finished her wine on the couch, listening to the dull thud of the clock. By the time Luke came home, she was drunk and sleepy. She'd meant to answer the door in the teddy. She wanted to be the first thing he saw, but she was too slow, and by the time he stepped inside, she was still splayed on the couch. He froze in front of her, still holding his keys.
"Are you okay?"
he said. She stood too quickly and lost her balance, grabbing the armrest to steady herself.
"Come here," she said.
"Are you drunk?"
She grabbed the teal drawstring on his scrubs and tugged him closer. She reached inside his pants and felt him staring at her in a way he never had before, pitying her desperation. When he pushed himself inside, she clenched her eyes and found sweetness in the pain. The next day, Luke asked Nadia if he could take her on a date. His face, inches from hers on her pillow, looked shy. She'd forgotten how curly his eyelashes were. The afternoon sun filtered in through the blinds and she felt lazy, warm, and stretching against her sheets.
"Maybe downtown," he said, "or the harbor. I don't know. Wherever you want to go."
She traced his tattoos, the maze of interlocking images that covered his left arm. When she'd last undressed him 7 years ago, he'd had a few tattoos, but now his full sleeve fascinated her. Tribal markings stretched over his shoulder, and near his elbow, a skull gritted its teeth. A fanged demon's tongue transformed into flames that licked up around Luke's wrist, a cross on his biceps, and above it, the words, "On my own." A lion's head covered Luke's left pectoral, the mane flowing away like smoke. The other half of his chest was smooth, bare, his right arm untouched. His ink stopped abruptly, like he'd slipped one arm into a sweater and forgotten about the other.
Why? She said.
Why what?
Why a date?
He pressed her hand against his heart and rolled onto his side. She'd always heard that men hated to cuddle, and it surprised her that Luke liked to be on the inside, cuddled by her. She had almost laughed the first time at the idea, but it made sense in a way, that everyone would want to be held. She wrapped her arms around him and kissed his muscled back.
I don't know, he said. I just want to take you somewhere nice.
What if someone sees us? She said.
Let them, he said. I don't care.
You're married.
What if I wasn't?
For a moment, she allowed herself to imagine it, how simple he made it seem, like a gate stood between him and freedom, and all he needed to do was slip a finger under the latch. Luke was good at this, always finding an escape. She remembered watching him on the football field, amazed by how his body seemed to know, down to the second, when to juke left or right, always aware of the direction danger appeared. He'd escaped her once before. She couldn't help him do the same to Aubrey. Aubrey sitting on that metal table inside the fertility doctor's office, how small she'd looked next to the size of her wanting.
You can't, she said.
Why not?
Because she loves you, she said.
We're just fucking around, but she loves you.
It's not just fucking, he said. Don't say that.
It is to me, she said.
He silently dressed, but paused halfway, his pants hanging at his ankles. He looked like he might cry, and she turned away. He didn't love her. He felt guilty. He'd abandoned her once, and now he was latching onto her, not out of affection, but out of shame. She refused to let him bury his guilt in her. She would not be a burying place for any man again. Luke forgot his watch on her nightstand, so the next morning she brought it to Upper Room. When she pulled into the parking lot, Mother Betty was shuffling across the street from the bus stop. The DMV had taken her license after she failed her last driving test.
They got me on those questions, she said.
Who knows the answers to all those little questions anyway? I've been driving 66 years and never hit nobody, but these people gonna say I can't drive because of their little questions.
She watched Mother Betty slowly sift through her ring of keys to unlock the front door, her hand shaking. It wasn't right. A woman her age waiting for the bus before daybreak.
I can give you a ride, Nadia said.
She fumbled through her purse for a piece of paper.
I'll give you my number, and you just call me when you're ready to go to work. Okay?
Oh, no, honey. I couldn't trouble you.
It's no trouble at all. Really, please.
She held out the scrap of notebook paper. Mother Betty hesitated, then accepted it.
You got a caring spirit, she said. I can sense it in you, just like your mama.
Nadia left Luke's watch on Mother Betty's desk. She drove home, glancing at her reflection in the rearview mirror. She touched the image, but did not see her mother's face, only smudged glass.
Chapter 12. Years later, we realized the watch should have told us everything. Only two reasons a woman might have someone's husband's watch. One, she's sleeping with him. Two, she repairs watches. Nadia Turner didn't look like a watchmaker to us. But even though the truth hadn't dawned on us yet, we still pitied Aubrey. On Sunday mornings, when we gathered around her in the church lobby, we felt her sadness swell. Agnes peered into the life of a baby girl born to parents who distrust each other. A girl who distrusts the world, too, for reasons she doesn't quite understand. She feels the coldness spreading between her parents and second-guesses everything. If her parents can pretend they are in love, what else could they be lying about to her? What else could the world keep from her, hold away in its hand? She may hear this story someday and wonder what it has to do with her. A girl hiding her scared in her prettiness, an unwanted baby, a dead mother. These are not her heartbreaks. Every heart is fractured differently, and she knows the pattern of her cracks. She traces them like lines across her palm. She has a living mother, and besides, she was always wanted, prayed for even. Now she's grown, or at least she thinks she is, but she hasn't yet learned the mathematics of grief. The weight of what has been lost is always heavier than what remains. She's heard her granddaddy preach about the good shepherd who leaves the 99 behind in search of the one lost sheep. But what about the flock he abandons? She wonders. Aren't they lost now, too? That fall, Nadia Turner mothered. In the gray mornings while her father slept, she scraped his keys off the hallway table and pulled his truck out of the driveway. She rolled down the window, sticking an arm out into the damp air, and cruised through quiet streets, past coffee shops flipping closed signs, women in bathrobes strapping backpacks on children at bus stops, surfers in wetsuits with boards racked on tops of trucks, until she reached a prim white house with blue trim. She began to feel like a valet, hopping out to help Mother Betty up the high truck stairs, especially once the other mothers began to ask her for rides.
"Oh, I hope you don't mind," Mother Betty said, "but I told Agnes you could carry her to the drugstore."
No, she didn't mind. She learned the curves of the roads that led to the mothers' homes. She'd never even thought of them having homes before. She wouldn't have been shocked to learn they stashed bedrolls in the choir closet and slept right on the pews. But Mother Agnes lived in a gray apartment building downtown, Mother Hattie in a rusty red house near the back gate. Mother Flora lived in an assisted living home called Fairwinds, which was across the street from an elementary school and a child care center. She was surrounded by death and children. Children outside her window toddling to daycare, children running around on playgrounds or biking home from school. Mother Flora was tall and willowy. She'd played basketball as a girl. Nadia learned other things, like Mother Clarice used to be a special education teacher, and her friends called her Clara. Mother Hattie was the best cook. Mother Betty had been the prettiest. Nadia wasn't quite sure how old the mothers were, but they must have been in their 80s or 90s by now. No surprise the DMV wanted them off the road. But she still felt sorry for them, especially Mother Betty, who for years had risen before everyone and arrived at Upper Room with her keys, so she made sure to pick her up early. She didn't feel guilty about sneaking out of the house anymore. Her father was getting stronger. In the afternoons, he walked in slow laps around the backyard, practicing his breathing exercises. She sometimes watched him through the glass while she read her bar exam books. She never wanted him to know she still worried about him, so when he took his medicine at night, she busied herself in his room,
dusting the nightstand or putting his laundry away, or idly straightening her mother's perfume bottles. She used to love playing with her mother's perfume, particularly one black bottle. Her mother only spritzed it on her neck when she and her father were going out for the night. So when Nadia held the bottle to her nose, she longed for a night when it had been exciting to watch her parents disappear through the door because she'd known they would always come back. She mothered as a penance, like sliding fingers along rosary beads. Each mile, its own prayer. If she gave her time selflessly, maybe she could forget the wrong she'd done. If she worked for no reward, if she was kind to people who could offer her nothing in return, maybe then her sins would be washed away. One afternoon, on the way to the drugstore, she mentioned that she'd recently found her mother's prayer book. Found, she'd said, because that was the simpler way to tell the story, editing out Luke's role altogether. The mothers began to chatter, the way they often did, jumping in and interrupting and finishing each other's sentences.
Oh, she used to love that thing, always carrying it under her arm. Didn't her mama give it to her?
Mm-hmm, that's what she told me. She was a minister, you know.
Not a minister, just a preaching woman.
Oh, what's the difference?
Minister needs a church.
Fine, a preaching woman. You knew that girl? Your grandmama used to baptize folks in the river.
Nadia had always been curious about her grandmother, but her mother did not like to talk about her much.
Oh, she was strict, her mother would say when Nadia had asked. Or, she sure loved Jesus.
Always broad, general statements, as if she were describing a character from a TV show she no longer followed. From the few photographs of her in the photo album, her grandmother seemed like a stern woman, but beyond that, she was a mystery. When she told the mothers this, they nodded sagely.
Well, they weren't much close.
That's a nice way of putting it.
That night, when Nadia asked her father what the mothers had meant, he told her that when her mother was pregnant with her, her own mother had thrown her out of the house.
She said that no child of hers would be living in sin under her household. So I sent your mom a Greyhound ticket, and she came out here to live with me.
He sighed.
Your grandma wanted nothing to do with us, and that was fine with me. But I never understood why she wouldn't meet you. Us, that's one thing. But a child? Your own grandchild? I don't know how anyone wouldn't want to know their grandchild.
She asked her father if her grandmother was still alive, and he shrugged.
As far as I know, he said. Still down in Texas, I'm sure.
As if he'd seen the wheels turning in her head, he added,
I'd leave all that alone. She made her choices. Chasing after her won't do no good.
She found a brown Polaroid in a photo album of her mother, posing with her brothers in front of their home. An address and date were scribbled across the back. She searched for more recent photos of the home online and tried to imagine her mother as a girl dancing on the porch. Maybe her grandmother still lived there. She didn't seem like the type of woman who would move around. She wondered what her grandmother would say if she showed up on that porch someday. Would she blink away grateful tears, glad to finally meet her granddaughter? Or would she shoo her off the steps like she had shooed her own daughter? Would she be angry that the source of their rift had materialized right in front of her?
Did Mom ever think about?
She paused, outlining the gold buttons on her purse with her finger.
Not having me?
What do you mean?
her father said. He placed a white pill on his tongue and flung his head back.
You know.
She swirled around the buttons so she wouldn't have to look at her father when she said the word abortion.
Did someone tell you that?
No, no. I was just wondering.
No, he said, never. She never would have done something like that.
Did you think? He paused, his eyes softening.
No, honey. We loved you. We always loved you.
She should have felt glad, but she didn't. She wished her mother had at least thought about it. A fleeting thought when she'd left the doctor and envisioned her own mother's face. During a hushed phone call with the man she loved. When she'd called a clinic to make her appointment and hung up in tears. When she'd sat in the waiting room holding her own hand. She could have been seconds away from doing it. It didn't matter. She hated the thought of her mother not wanting her, but it would have been better to look at her mother's face in the mirror and know that they were alike. 3 weeks after he'd seen Nadia last, Luke squatted over his back steps, striking a match against the railing. Dave's suggestion. Light a candle, he'd told Luke, the last time he called the helpline. Dave hadn't said what type of candle. A scented candle like the ones in Luke's mother's bathroom. A tiny tea candle placed on restaurant tables. A thick red candle emblazoned with the Virgin Mary you found in the Mexican food aisle. A birthday candle, rainbow striped and slender. Any type of candle would do, Dave had said. So Luke bought a pack of slender white candles. He sat on the back steps of the house, cupping his hands against the flame. It was supposed to bring closure, David said. Peace. But as soon as he'd lit the candle, Luke only felt stressed. A light evening breeze rustled through the trees, and he hunched behind a shrub, trying to shelter the flame, suddenly responsible for guarding the fragile thing. Dave was a counselor at the Family Life Center in downtown San Diego. Luke had found their flyer stuck in his windshield outside a bar a few weeks ago. Looking for real options? The yellow flyer asked, above a picture of a pregnant woman holding her head and a man next to her, staring off into the distance. It was the first pregnancy center flyer Luke had ever seen with a picture of a man on it. The others only held sad, alone women. On pregnancy center flyers, men were as absent in the midst of a surprise pregnancy as they were in real life. As absent as he'd been. He called the number just to see what it was about. He told himself he'd hang up. But the on-duty counselor, Dave, started talking to him about the myth that only women suffer after abortions. Men suffer a unique type of loss, Dave said. Men struggle after losing their child to abortion because they've failed to perform the primary function of a father, protecting his family. Luke had never thought of it like that. He and Nadia hadn't been a family. They were just two scared kids. But what if they had been? What if, for a brief moment, they had been family, stitched together by the life they'd created? What did that make them now? Now Luke called the center every other evening. He hung up if anyone other than Dave answered. He'd told Dave about the boy at the baseball game years ago. Dave didn't judge him. It was normal, he'd said, for post-abortive fathers to feel grief. Once you had created a life, you would always be a father, no matter what happened to the child. Luke fished his phone out of his pocket and dialed, careful to keep the candle lit. "This you, Luke?" Dave asked.
"Yeah. How are you, buddy?"
"Fine."
"Just fine?" Yeah.
Okay.
Dave cleared his throat.
Thought any more about coming into the center?
I can't, Luke said.
It'll help you, trust me, talking to someone face to face. It's a lot better than over the phone. Sometimes you just need to see someone. Know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't bite, promise, Dave laughed. And I got some books I can give you if you come down. This one.
His voice strained, like he was reaching for something.
Great one, called A Father's Heart. It's by this guy named I Gotta Go, Luke said. Hold on, pal. Don't run off. I'll just hold these for you when you're ready, okay?
Okay.
So what's on your mind?
I bought the candles, Luke said.
Great, Dave said. Light a candle and close your eyes. Picture your child playing on a field at the feet of Jesus.
Luke closed his eyes, the candle's warmth flickering across his face. He tried to envision the scene Dave described, but he only saw Nadia, her smile, her hazel eyes. Then he felt the burn. A glob of hot wax dripped onto his hand. He cringed, scraping the wax off against the step. Gravel and dirt clung to his skin. He should have put the candle inside something. Why hadn't he thought of that? Behind him, the back door swung open, and his wife leaned against the doorway, frowning.
What are you doing?
Aubrey said.
Nothing.
What's with the candle, then? You're dripping wax all over the place.
She towed the white blob on the steps. Luke leaned forward, blowing out the flame.
He was only making a bigger mess. When you gonna settle down, girl?
Mother Betty asked Nadia one morning.
You always flitting around here and there. You think life is for wandering about, looking for what makes you happy? Those just white girl dreams and fantasies. You need to settle down, find a good man. Look at Aubrey Evans. When you gonna do the same?
Luke no longer came by to visit her father, but she passed him in upper room sometimes. He always looked shy of speaking, but he never even mumbled a hello, his eyes tracing the worn carpet. That sliver of space between them when they passed in a narrow hallway felt electric. She told herself she could not think about him. She needed to be good. She began to meet Aubrey on her lunch break when they sat at a table by the window and shared coffee. She thought about confessing, but every time the words clung to the roof of her mouth. What good would come of telling the truth? She had ended things with Luke. What good would come of Aubrey knowing all the ways they had betrayed her? She never went to Aubrey's house, but once a week, she met Aubrey for dinner at Monique and Casey's. Returning to the little white house made her feel like a teenager again. She wanted to stay up late eating ice cream or lounge in the backyard until the light grew dim, her future awaiting her, unblemished and free. She and Aubrey walked to the corner store for snacks or sat in her old bedroom, painting their nails. She always propped Aubrey's feet into her lap and painted her toenails. It seemed like a small thing she could give. By Halloween, Nadia had become such a fixture around Upper Room that the pastor had asked her to help chaperone the children's Halloween party. She said yes. She said yes to nearly everything anyone at Upper Room asked of her. At first, she'd only offered the mother's rides, but now, while her father continued to heal, she began to loan his truck. She and Second John lifted dozens of folding chairs into the truck bed for the men's fellowship. She drove across town to pick up a new drum kit for the choir. She carried the food baskets from the homeless ministry to the shelter.
She had grown up and found God, people thought, but she hadn't found anything. She was searching for her mother. She hadn't found her in any of the old places, but maybe she could find her at Upper Room, a place she'd loved, a place she'd visited right before dying. If she could not find her mother in the last place she'd been breathing, she would never find her at all. The Halloween party did not require much hauling, besides the decorations, but she still agreed to help. Each year, the church handed out candy, the least offensive way to commemorate a holiday whose demonic origins worried them, but whose popularity was too great to ignore. Costumes were allowed, but only positive characters. Superheroes, but no villains and nobody dead. Bible figures were preferred, but no one knew whether Bible characters skirted the death rule. Each year, a smart aleck dressed in a mummy costume and called himself Lazarus. That evening, she barely recognized the children's church room. The lights were out, but the ceiling was covered in plastic glowing stars. If darkness was required for Halloween events, that didn't mean it couldn't be combated by celestial light. The children crammed into the room and darted down the hallways with plastic sacks filled with candy. Bearded Noahs dragged stuffed animals behind them. Adams juggled half-bitten apples. Moseses carried paper tablets under their arms. And Marys rocked baby dolls. In the doorway, Nadia perched on a chair with a bucket of candy between her legs. These were the moments when adulthood was formed, not a birthday, but the realization that she was now the one pouring a handful of candy into children's bags, that she was now the one expected to give, not receive. Aubrey and Luke arrived later. When they'd texted, Aubrey hadn't mentioned that she would bring Luke. But why would she? He was her husband. Wasn't it expected that he would always be with her? He wore a long brown bathrobe, and whenever a kid asked who he was, he flexed and said that he was Samson. But his hair was short, so all evening the children beat him up, and he had to take it.
"Who are you supposed to be?" Aubrey asked. She carried a pair of scissors.
"Delilah." "Nobody," Nadia said. She hadn't known what to wear, so when children asked, she said that she was no one, a peasant. All night, they sat in the children's church doorway listening to the laughter. She watched the ancient lovers give out sweets under the fake starlight, Samson lounging on the plastic chair, his bum leg stretched out into the hallway because it got stiff and painful if he folded it. He plucked pink starbursts out of the bucket and gave a handful to Aubrey because they were her favorite. Later in the night, Aubrey rested her head against his shoulder, and the brief contact felt so intimate, Nadia looked away. The night was brisk and dim, the sliver of moon barely illuminating the sky. When Aubrey went to the bathroom, Nadia stepped inside the children's church room to refill her bucket. She leaned against the window, listening to the faint yelping of coyotes, when Luke leaned closer to her.
"I've been talking to this guy named Dave," he said.
"Who's Dave?"
"He doesn't think it's good that we never talk about him." He swallowed. "Our baby."
A flock of angels skipped by in shimmery white dresses. This was a strange, lopsided universe. All saints but no sinners. Angels but no demons. An off-kilter world where girls mothered old women and betrayed their best friends.
"We don't have to be sad anymore. Dave says he's in heaven right now."
Luke smiled, reaching for her hand.
and your mom's holding him.
Luke gazed out the window, and under the faint moonlight, he looked almost peaceful when he talked about their baby, who, like their love, was miraculous and fleeting. She squeezed Luke's hand. If this was what he needed, she wanted him to believe it. She wanted him to believe it all.
That Sunday morning, Aubrey saw a Marine in the receiving line. She ordinarily didn't notice faces when she helped greet the congregation, still overwhelmed by the crowds who gathered to shake hands with the first family, a family she now belonged to, and she shuffled mechanically, repeating the same greeting, offering hugs, agreeing to coffee dates she would soon forget. She wouldn't have noticed the Marine at all if not for his uniform. Dress blues, hat tucked under his arm, gold buttons glinting in the light. When he stepped forward, she glanced up into his face and snatched her hand back.
"Oh," she said.
Russell Miller smiled, the same purposeful smile she'd seen on the beach years ago, the smile of a man who knew sadness and spent great energy warding it away. She knew that smile, because it was a smile she'd long practiced and perfected. She hid behind that smile, but no one saw it in her the way she saw it in Russell. He reached past her to shake Pastor Shepherd's hand.
"Great message, Reverend," he said.
She suddenly felt exposed, like the whole church would notice her standing beside Russell and know. Know what? That once upon a time, days before her wedding, she had kissed him in a beach bathroom stall? That after she'd gotten married, when Russell should have been banished to her memory, she still wrote him?
"Let's talk outside," she said.
Months ago, Russell had emailed her and announced that his tour overseas was ending. "Coming back to the States soon. Wanna grab lunch?" She'd hated the fake casualness of it, as if he were an old high school friend in town who just wanted to catch up. Of course she wanted to see him again, but they both knew she couldn't. She was married. She was loved by one man, and it was wrong. Greedy, really, to ask for more.
"What are you doing here?"
she said, once they'd stepped behind the church. Russell shrugged.
"You didn't answer my email, so I figured I'd come by."
"Maybe I didn't answer for a reason."
"Which is?"
"I'm married."
"Married women can't eat lunch?"
"Not with strange men."
"I'm a strange man,"
she sighed.
"You know what I mean."
"I don't," he said. "I've been halfway around the world and back, and all I want to do is take you to lunch. I don't mean nothing funny by it. You just kept my spirits up while I was gone, and I want to thank you. Your husband can even come if he wants."
She told Russell she would mention his invitation to Luke, but on their silent drive home from church, she stared out the window, imagining Russell beneath her on the bathroom floor, his large hands gripping her waist.
"What are you thinking about?"
Luke said.
"Me?"
He smiled.
"Of course you."
"I don't know. I'm not thinking anything."
He eased onto the brakes as he pulled up to a traffic light. Then he pried her hand from her lap, guided it to his mouth, and bit one of her fingers.
"What are you doing?"
she said. He grinned and bit another one.
"Ouch," she said, laughing. "Stop, you goof."
Then Luke kissed her hand and held it between his. And for the rest of the drive, she imagined her life caught between his teeth, her trusting him not to bite. 2 days later, she met Russell at Ruby's Diner on the pier.
Even though he wore a blue gingham shirt with a tie and stood when she approached the booth, she reminded herself that this wasn't a date. Nothing intimate or romantic about lunch on the pier, where seagulls called and swooped overhead. Russell ordered a beer with his fish and chips. She ordered a Coke and a chicken salad. Then later, a piece of lemon meringue pie to split. Not because she was still hungry, but because she wanted their lunch to last longer. She'd worried at first that she'd feel awkward around him, but she was surprised by how natural she felt, chatting about mundane things like the church picnic or her sister. Then Russell asked how her fertility appointment had gone.
"Fine," she said.
She had received a message weeks ago from Dr. Yavari's office to confirm her follow-up appointment. She'd deleted the message. What would be the point of going back? Of consulting an expert to help make a baby that Luke didn't even want? No wonder he'd never cared, while she'd obsessed over their inability to conceive. He only cared about the baby he'd lost years ago. He only cared about the baby he'd made with Nadia.
"You think your husband wants a boy?" Russell asked.
"I don't know. He never said."
Had their baby been a boy or a girl? Did it matter? The baby had probably been whatever Luke wanted.
"People always think men want boys," Russell said, "like we couldn't imagine loving something that isn't exactly like ourselves."
"You wouldn't want a son?"
"Too dangerous," he said. "Black boys are target practice. At least black girls got a chance."
"I don't think that's true."
"What's not true? Why you think I enlisted? My pops told me, you better learn to shoot before these white men shoot you. And I did. I've been all the way to Iraq, and I could walk down the street here and get my head blown off. You don't know what that's like."
She scoffed.
"I'm scared all the time," she said. "I never feel safe."
"Well, you got your husband to protect you."
"My husband's the one who hurts me," she said. "He thinks I don't know he's in love with someone else."
She had never said it out loud before. There was something freeing in admitting that you had been loved less. She might have gone her whole life not knowing, thinking that she was enjoying a feast when she had actually been picking at another's crumbs. Across the table, Russell slid his hand on top of hers. She stared at his rough skin. Then the waiter came by with the bill, and she forced herself to pull away. First, John told Luke about the pie. A slice of lemon meringue shared between his wife and another man at a diner on the pier. The men were moving folding chairs into the meeting room before men's Bible study when the head usher broached the topic, a little bashfully, his eyes scraping the floor. First, John's wife had been at lunch with one of her girlfriends earlier that week, and she'd happened to see Aubrey sharing lunch with a man. A congregation member, she'd thought at first, but she'd never seen him around church before. The man had seemed hungry. His eyes never left Aubrey's face.
"I don't mean to stir up no mess," First John said, "but I'd want to know if it was my wife."
The pie had angered Luke the most. A lunch may have just been a meal, but splitting dessert was intimate. His wife and this strange man dipping forks into the soft cream, her fork, then his, then hers again, falling into an easy rhythm. This man must have watched her lift the fork to her mouth, his hungry eyes following as it disappeared between her lips. Maybe later, in a dark corner of the parking structure, he'd sucked the meringue off her tongue.
"How was your date?" he said when he returned home.
Aubrey was sitting on the couch folding laundry.
She wore a brown shirt, a baggy gray cardigan that hung open to her waist, the type of drab outfit that made Luke feel, in that moment, that both of them were older than they had any right to be.
"It wasn't a date," she said.
"Then what was it?"
"Lunch."
"How come you didn't tell me about it then?"
"I don't have to tell you about every lunch I go to."
"If you're out with some strange nigga, then yes, you fucking do."
He never yelled at her. He snapped sometimes, but he always felt horrible after, because she flinched when he raised his voice, which made him feel as guilty as if he'd actually hit her. He would never hit her, but he felt that she believed it was always possible. So he'd forced himself to monitor his anger around her, to quiet his voice, to control his body, to never punch a wall or throw a glass like he'd so badly wanted to. He never wanted her to feel scared of him the way she felt around most men. But not this man she'd gone to lunch with. If Luke were married to another woman, he might have believed that lunch was just lunch. But he knew Aubrey. She didn't have male friends she went out with alone. If she'd gone to meet up with this man, lunch had to mean more. She stared at him evenly.
"I never ask where you go," she said. "I never ask when you're sneaking off to see Nadia."
He swallowed.
"That's different," he said.
"Why? Because you love her?"
She laughed a little, shaking her head.
"I'm not stupid. I'm not in law school, but I'm not stupid."
"Please," he said,
"stop.
You don't have to lie to me anymore. You've always loved her. Please, she's the one you want."
"Please," he said.
Her calmness scared him. He would understand if she had screamed and yelled or cried and cursed. He expected her to, but she was eerily calm, and that was how he knew she would leave him. Maybe not right away, but someday he would return home and find her shelf cleared in the bathroom, her half of the closet empty. He'd be lonelier than he had been at the rehab center before she'd brought him a donut wrapped carefully in crinkly paper, a small gift he hadn't imagined himself capable of receiving. He stood in the doorway while she folded his sweaters across her chest, her arms holding his arms and crossing them into her heart. Chapter 13.
"I just don't know that girl's problem," Betty said. "We all peeked out the blinds, watching Nadia Turner pull out of the church parking lot. For weeks, she'd been silent and rude. She hardly spoke when she pulled up to our houses, answering in one word when we tried to be friendly. For that type of company, we would have been better off hiring a taxi. When she picked us up from church, she always paced outside of her truck like she was late or something. Where she got to go? Who she got waiting for her but her daddy? And not like he was going anywhere."
"Maybe she worried about her friend," Flora said.
"What she got to worry about?
They married.
Married folk got problems.
Y'all heard Aubrey moved out?" "Oh, who hadn't done that once or twice?"
Agnes said. "Y'all know how many times I packed me a suitcase and left Ernest," Betty said. "Went running to my mama's house, and after a few days, I was right back. That ain't nothing. That's what married folk do."
"I heard that shepherd boy got a wandering eye."
"He a man, ain't he?" Hattie said. "What these girls expect?"
Agnes said,
"See, that's the problem with colored girls these days. They too hard. Soft things can take a beating, but you push something hard a little bit and it shatters. You gotta be a soft thing in love. Hard love don't last."
I still don't see what none of this got to do with Nadia Turner. Betty shook her head, staring back out the window.
"Don't say hello to nobody, don't speak. And why's she always walking back and forth like that? Like she got so many other places to be?"
What we didn't understand then was that when Nadia dropped us off at Upper Room, she paced in front of her daddy's truck so she could watch cars pass on the road. Sometimes she sat on the steps in front of the church for an hour or two, hoping that she might see a green Jeep pull into the parking lot. She never did. No one had seen Aubrey Evans for weeks. For months, Nadia replayed in her mind